Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it. Again, my name is Nathan Rajewski. I work currently with Kawartha Conservation, which is a conservation authority, one of 36 in Ontario. And we are located just here in Lindsay. And today I'm just going to be talking a bit about how I got into conservation, sort of my background from when I was younger and what I was doing then that got me into the environmental field. Talk a bit about my education and some other avenues that got me to where I'm at today. And then I'll go into what work we do at Kawartha Conservation, just so you guys get a better idea of what my job is. And from there, then I'll dive into a bit of the work that I've done with Bruce and many other volunteers in the area, some of our volunteer work. And then I'll end off with kind of what I'm doing currently, which is primarily flood forecasting. And we'll get into that in a bit. Now, I just want to make sure that this clicker works. Perfect. All right. So before I start, I guess I just wanted to get a feel of knowledge in the room as to, you know, who here knows about environmental work, whether that's the work of the MNR or even conservation authorities. If I could get a, you know, set of hands as to who's familiar. Okay, yep. Now, I know Bruce mentioned there's a couple Fleming profs here as well, so that's good, some extra knowledge there. But I guess what I'll start with here is intro to myself. So again, I work at Kawartha Conservation. Currently, I'm a watershed resource technician, which is a big fancy word for I do lots of stuff, lots of technical things. Again, I appreciate you guys having me and whatnot. So what we're going to be talking about today is intro to myself a bit, some of my roles and responsibilities that I've taken on over the last 4 years. I'm 27, just for background, so for the last 4 years I've been employed with Kawartha. Then I'll go into a bit of what we do, as I mentioned, some of our departments and programs. I'll specifically talk about my department. And then we'll go into community science, which is that volunteer program, a bit of the data that we've collected with the program, and you know, some of the reasoning behind why we do volunteer work. And then again, I'll talk about flood forecasting. So a bit about me. I grew up in Uxbridge, Ontario, with my parents and my brother, doing lots of sports and swimming and all sorts of activities. When I was younger, my father and my mother purchased a cottage up north between Apsley and Bancroft on a lake called Eels Lake. Beautiful lake, and I have to give credit to my dad and my mom for purchasing that home, as that's what's really got me into the work that I do today. We got in lots of trouble up there, you know, sneaking around, boating when we shouldn't, lots of swimming and lots of fishing. Those were the things that got me into, you know, the outdoors, right? A lot of kids nowadays, too, they're all inside, right? They're not getting out. They're not enjoying nature and whatnot. So I'm very grateful to have that that memory of when I was younger and enjoying those things, fishing, swimming, boating. Archery was a big thing that I did at my cottage, and it was those things that brought me to where I'm at today, why I enjoy the environment. My cottage was always sort of an escape for me. You know, when you're younger and you're dealing with school and whatnot, in Uxbridge at least for me, it was nice to be able to, well, my parents drove the 2.5 hours north to take us to our cottage and enjoy the time there. After a while, you know, going through grade school and high school, I knew that environmental was the direction I wanted to go. There was lots of schools and opportunities that I could apply for. Unfortunately, my math grades weren't the best, and specifically my physics, I struggled with that. So university was going to be a little, you know, far of a step for me. But I did visit Fleming College here in Lindsay, which is a great environmental school. And the few days that I spent there kind of learning about what they do and what they teach, I knew that that's where I wanted to go. So I took the three-year advanced diploma environmental technology course. And what environmental technology is essentially, it's a mix of everything that goes into the environmental field. So whether it's water quality, whether it's technical equipment, programming of equipment, GIS, which is, you know, we have a member here who was a prof for GIS for a while at Fleming, all sorts of things combined into one. And the reason I liked that is because it was a little tough for me to decide what I really wanted to dive into. I spent 3 years there, and it was a great time. Some of the best years I've had, and, you know, unfortunately, the ending was a little bit different. At that time, COVID was just starting up, so I didn't get to graduate with my other classmates. We kind of got sent home one day, and that was it. I didn't get to say bye to my profs or any of my classmates, really, and things turned to online, which kind of sucked, to be honest. And then after that, I worked at my local golf course for a year or two, and then I applied to Kawartha Conservation. And for the last 4 years, as I mentioned, that's where I've been at, and that's what I've been doing. So at Kawartha Conservation, I've had a couple different roles over the years. I started off as a student, so very basic work, right? Helping out the other crew members, simple water quality work. We were out on the boat a lot, so I was learning, you know, how we sample out on the boat. And just general help with programs. At the end of the year, my boss sort of saw my enthusiasm, my energy, and she liked it, and she wanted to keep me on for a little longer. So she extended me for a couple more months to the end of the year. And at that point, I continued to just help the team, and she sat down with me and said, hey, I really like what you're offering us. You know, great personality and whatnot. Not to toot my own horn, but whatever. She enjoyed the work I was doing, so she kept me on for another year. And in the environmental world, often contract work is very common. In the MNR, it's the same, a lot of contracts. So for my second year, it was a full contract, the full year. And I slowly got more responsibilities. I started helping out with some of our other departments, helped out more with our sampling, more with biomonitoring, which is a really fun avenue that we do, a fun program. And I started also helping with flood forecasting, which maybe some of you are familiar with flood forecasting. It's essentially just making sure areas don't flood and trying to give advance notice. So I was helping some staff members with that. And at the end of that year, again, we want to keep you on, so I got another contract. More responsibilities, started taking on some of the volunteer work that we do, and scaled that up, thankfully, which was great. And now, currently, I'm full-time there, and I guess they're happy with me, so that's a good thing. So now I'm full-time, and my official title now is Watershed Resource Technician. So a bit more about my current role. So as of today, the main work I do is with flood forecasting. A gentleman, his name is Rob Stavinga. Some of you may know him. He lives here in Lindsay. He worked at Kawartha for many years, and I sort of shadowed him for my first 3 years, and he recently retired, so I took on some of the work he was doing. And at the time, flood forecasting was a piece that he was helping with, and our work decided that, you know, we're going to make me the sole operator in the flood program, so a flood duty officer. So that's a big part of what I do. Now, I did argue with my boss, basically saying, hey, as much as I want to work on this flood work, this flood program, I also still want to go out in the field. I still want to go out on the boats. I still want to go jumping creeks and, you know, have fun. So thankfully, I still get to do a lot of that work, which is great. Additionally, I also teach kids a couple of our programs that we have. We have a few lesson plans, mainly bugs. So it's called aquatic benthic macroinvertebrates. It's a big word. Basically means bugs in creeks. And we use these bugs to help identify water quality. So I teach a lot about that to kids. And then other things like rocks and minerals sometimes, and you know, anything else. As I mentioned, volunteer programs, that was a big thing that I did over the last 4 years, and I've scaled them up, thankfully. And then various other tasks, right? All jobs, you know, you end up getting thrown other things, you wear lots of hats, and that's just part of the job. So that's basically an intro to myself. Any questions on that, or we're good? Awesome. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I'll get into that very shortly, but IWM is one of our departments. It's the department I work in, so it stands for Integrated Watershed Management. It essentially is, I'll talk about it shortly, but it's basically science-y nerds who work together on various programs, and that's the department that I work in. So there you are. Yes, go right ahead. Correct. Yes. Yep. I'll quickly, and then I'll touch again later on when I talk about sort of our biomonitoring, but definitely can explain it now. Yep. For sure. I'll start with the crayfish. So, from my understanding, and again, I'm not a biologist. We have a biologist at our office. His name's Brett Trigano. I do know that in terms of the crayfish, there are a lot of invasive crayfish that are in our waters. The big one, I'd say it dominates almost 100% of this category, is the rusty crayfish. How it got here and its, you know, progression throughout waterways, I don't really know how that's occurred. A lot of those kind of species, they ultimately get moved around from boats to anything that goes in the water, your dock. Sometimes people, you know, move their docks out, and things can, you know, travel from lake to lake, essentially, creek to creek. But it definitely is something that has, you know, been in our scope, invasive species, that is. And then on your topic of electrofishing, so again, I'll talk about it a bit more, but electrofishing is essentially you're using current to get fish to move to a certain location. So we are in the water with a backpack unit. It's got a big battery in it. And essentially we are pumping current through the water to somewhat stun the fish. They don't die. I believe the literature says it's around 1% of the fish that you capture end up dying. But for the most part, when I do electrofishing, we don't ever have, you know, fatalities in the fish. But essentially, the electricity in the water takes over their body. It's called electrotaxis. It's where the fish, if they're swimming away from your electrofishing unit, they will ultimately get turned towards it, and their body will uncontrollably swim towards your unit, and then they will be stunned on the top of the water. We collect them, and then we ID them. And then, I mean, sometimes before you even get it back in the net, they're back to life trying to get away. So some people hear electrofishing and they think we're just stunning them to death. We're not at all. All the fish get re-released back into the creek. And again, I'll talk a bit more about that and some other biomonitoring. So as mentioned, I work for Kortha Conservation, which is one of 36 conservation authorities in Ontario today. Now, one thing we should talk about is in the conservation world, we are undergoing amalgamation. And maybe some of you have heard of that, but amalgamation is basically where you take a large group of organizations, individual, and you bring them together to a smaller number. So as much as we have 37 now, come next year, there will only be, I believe, 7 in Ontario. and they're basically taking the borders that they work in, as seen here. So this is our watershed. They're taking the various borders and putting them together, kind of like a puzzle, and then they're calling that a new organization. So, for example, we're Kawartha Conservation. Well, we will ultimately be known as ELORCA, which is Eastern Lake Ontario Region Conservation Authority. So quite a long name. Yeah, so I'll have to get used to saying that. It's easy, Kawartha Conservation. It's kind of like Kawartha Dairy. Some people, you know, get a little confused sometimes. But anyways, we're going to be amalgamating. So that's a big change that's coming up in the future. But currently, we operate as Kawartha Conservation. And I'm glad to be a part of something that's going to be no longer around shortly. So we've had a good time. But our main office, again, is located in Kenreid, or at Kenreid Conservation Area here in Lindsay. We're a conservation authority. We do lots of work from planning and permitting to CA lands management, so conservation area management, lands management. We do what I do, the IWM department, so anything water-related, aquatic species-related, monitoring of any part of the watershed, that's what we do. Very similar to the MNR, but just scaled down, if you will. Again, I'll show this map again. We also operate based on a municipal kind of method where we get funds from municipalities and run programs for them. So a big part of our watershed is City of Kawartha Lakes. So they're a big partner, a big municipal partner for us. So we operate CKL programs for them that range from lake programs to stewardship programs to tributary monitoring. So that's your creeks. Anytime I say tributary, it means a creek. And then we have other municipalities, Scugog, Brock, Clarington, Trent Lakes, and Cavan Monaghan, small portion of Cavan Monaghan. I'm sure you guys know this area pretty well. So as the gentleman asks, what is IWM? So IWM, again, it's basically a bunch of science nerds, that's how I like to put it. We do things from lake-based monitoring, so that's going out on the lakes with boats, sampling water, sampling sediment, looking at aquatic plants. You know, I'm not sure if how many of you are living on the lakes, but weeds, aquatic weeds, they're becoming an issue, right? So monitoring those, identifying what they are they invasive, are they native, those sorts of things. Tributary monitoring, so that's our streams, whether it's Blackstock Creek or Emily Creek or you name it, we're monitoring those creeks. And what we do there is often, it's called flow. It's basically looking at how much water is passing through that stream over a given period of time. Then we get into water quality. Again, water quality is a big part of what we do. Almost every program that we operate, we also have water quality. So this involves taking, you know, bottles, sample bottles, and scooping the water, sending it off to a lab. It gets analyzed for things like nutrients, heavy metals, E. coli is a big one now. The list can be endless for what you want analyzed, but that's a big part of what we do is water quality. We also use water quality meters, which are essentially electronic devices that help identify sort of the chemistry in the water. The reason we use those is because the lab can't analyze for them. So I'll quickly show you. So this here is a water quality meter. So this is the handheld unit right here. And this is the probe end. So this goes in the water. We pull this probe out right there. And that goes in the water. And that will tell us stuff like water temperature, conductivity. Conductivity is where what's the electrical potential of the water. Basically helps identify, is there salt in the water? Things like dissolved oxygen, very important for fish, various species. And these are very expensive. This is about $30,000, just this unit right here. So this work is, it can get expensive depending on what kind of equipment you use, but this is top of the line, and that's why we take good care of it. All right, moving on. So stream and discharge, again, I talked a bit about that. That's looking at how much water is moving through a stream over a given period of time. Biomonitoring, that's similar to the electrofishing we talked about. So that's anything related to living species. So your fish, your bugs in the water, plants even, aquatic plants. It's all part of biomonitoring, and I'll talk a bit about it in a moment. Flood forecasting, we've sort of discussed that a bit, but I'll touch on that at the end of today's presentation. And then provincial monitoring, that's a big part. Provincial monitoring is basically the province approaching us and saying, hey, can you routinely monitor these lakes or streams once a month? So for 12 months throughout the year, we go out to the exact same spot and do water quality, basically. Those are fun days, too. And yet, ultimately, again, it's all about collecting data, and then we use that data to provide guidance to municipalities or, in some cases, even the province on sort of big topics. So again, I'll just skim through some of this stuff. Lake-based monitoring, again, big part of it's water quality. So we're going out on the boats and we're doing those water samples. We also do sediment sampling. This is a new thing we've been doing the last 2 years. Basically, you take this large dredge. It's a big, heavy piece of equipment, and you drop it into the water with a rope, obviously, and it sinks to the bottom. It grabs sediment, and then you lift it up, and you scoop that up, that actual sand and mud and whatnot, and you send that to a laboratory. And that'll tell you things like PCBs or heavy metals that are, in the lake and they're not going anywhere. So those are things from 40 years ago that would have been put into the lake, and they sink to the bottom and they stay there. It's very important work. We also do the fish work, so whether that's electrofishing or seine netting. Seine netting is basically using a large net to capture fish, and then you identify them, mark down what you found, populations and whatnot, and then you release them. And then aquatic plant surveys. So that's a big part of what we're doing now. A lot of people are really concerned with the plants in the lakes, and essentially what we're trying to do is identify, okay, what plants are out there? Are they native? Are they not native? And we do that with, actually, it's a hard rake. We throw the hard rake in the water with a rope tied to the end, and then we drag that out of the water, and up comes this big mat of aquatic plants, similar to what you see kind of down there. Any questions on that? Yep, so the question, I guess, was what are we doing with the data we collect? So I know currently this is primarily done, this work's done through our aquatic biologist, but I know that he does great reports on density. So this helps identify, okay, what areas and lakes are the most dense with plants. Are they native? Are they not? And I know ultimately it does help. It gets fed into, whether it's municipal or private activities where, a large part of the issue is that we're trying to get homeowners to reduce the use of fertilizers on their lawns. And the reason I say that is because plants, they eat up fertilizer. It's their food. It makes them grow. It makes them grow more and more. And one approach we're trying is through stewardship to identify, hey, if you have a property on a waterfront, do your best to reduce the amount of fertilizer you're putting out on your lawn, right? I know everyone likes to have a nice, lush lawn, right? But reducing fertilizer usage is a big target. There is also discussions currently, and it's not part of any of our programming, of mechanical harvesting. That's something that's done. We don't do it here necessarily. In Lake Scugog, they do have one that the municipality uses to help harvest, at least at the Bay of Port Perry. But it's a tough one because it's unfortunately it's got out of hand really quickly. And currently there's slowly steps getting, you know, implemented to help remediate. So that would be my best answer for you. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes.
Yep. I just need to be the question guy, but
no worries.
If you do core samples, when you go down into the silk, you pull out a sample so that you can tell the years of like what that particular element was introduced into the water.
Yep. So basically like layering. See the layers and the kind of the deeper ones are older. So currently we don't do that. We do soil work on land. So we will take core samples on land for other programs. It's not what I personally do. Currently we are just doing the bottom dredge, which goes down about a foot of soil. And ultimately we're more looking at the contaminants in the soil, not necessarily stratifying. Stratifying means like layering. We're not really looking for layering because ultimately when we pull up that sediment, we mix it together. So it becomes what's called a homogeneous mixture, basically like a smoothie. And that's what gets sent to the lab. So not necessarily a core, but similar. Any other questions? Oh, okay, here we go. Yes. We do. In a way, we monitor for E. coli. If you've heard of E. coli, it's basically a bacteria in the gut of, you know, animals and humans and whatnot. It's what comes out of your septic tank, really. And it's definitely present in sewage. So we do monitor for E. coli, but we don't specifically target sewage release into lakes. Is that your question, kind of? Yes. Yeah, so any of the E. coli monitoring is sort of targeted to those applications, right? Old septic tanks, stuff like that. We're trying to see how much is being leached out into the lakes, into our groundwater. So that is the approach that we do, yeah. We are finding... the question was evidence of heavy metals and PCBs. We have found both. PCBs is a different sort of analysis. It's a bit more expensive. And I'd have to refer to our water quality specialist. But heavy metals, definitely. We do see a lot of heavy metals in our lakes and even in our streams. Less in our streams than the lakes, but... Yep. So we don't test the snow, which is, you know what, it's something I've really not thought of, and maybe I'll bring it up, is let's melt this snow and test it. But a large program we do is called Snow Survey. It's basically twice a month during the winter. We go out to four different locations and measure the snow. That's part of flood forecasting, which is why there's not that water quality lab piece that you refer to. Basically what we're looking at is how much snow, how much water resides in the snow, and then that can translate to, okay, how much flooding is going to happen in the spring, right? And for the last 2 years, I'm sure many of you have seen some of the flooding that's gone on. That's why we do that program. Yep. Yep, for sure. So the question was, how is the sediment analyzed? So from my understanding... We basically package it in bottles, similar to the water quality. So just like scooping the water, while we scoop the sediment that we bring up, and then that gets sent to the lab, and they use something called a mass spectrophotometer, I believe. It's a very expensive machine. I believe they're like over $1 million for just that type of machine, and basically if I understand correctly, it burns the soil at a super high temperature. And then based on the colors that come off of that soil, they can identify what is present in the soil. And that's, I believe, how they do it. Yep. Different things, for sure. Yeah, I'd have to agree, definitely. I don't know how I'd be able to comment on that, to be honest. Yeah. Well, that's definitely a no-no. We don't like that. I do know, though, that, you know, from my limited knowledge, you know, heavy metals are present in the water. Often it can come from your boats and whatnot. I know a while back that gasoline had certain heavy metals in it, so that's all my knowledge really regarding that, but that's a good point to bring up. So, okay, move on here. Talked about lake monitoring. We'll go to tributary monitoring. So again, here we're doing a lot of water quantity. So we talked about water quality. Water quantity is amount, how much water is flowing through the stream. So we use these meters in the water. They're also like $20,000. It's, you know, the environmental world's very expensive, but we use them to monitor how much water is passing by. First, we get depths. So we get the depth of the creek at each different points. And then we get the speed of the water moving past. And with a calculation, you can determine how much water passes by in, let's say, a 24-hour period. We also do electrofishing a lot in our creeks. That's a very effective way to get fish populations. We also do what's called OBBN. In simple terms, it's bugs in the water. And basically, there's sensitive bugs and there's tolerant bugs. Tolerant ones can live in water that has, you know, chemicals and pollution, whereas sensitive ones like mayflies and dragonflies, they can't live in water with contamination. So that's that piece. We've gone over a good bit of this through just discussion, water quality, but again, it's one of our biggest programs. Collecting water samples, taking the data, and applying it to reports or stewardship activities. The municipality uses a lot of our work as well. But a lot of the times we're looking for various nutrients, heavy metals, salts, which is chloride, and then E. coli. Those are the most common analysis that we do. And then, as I mentioned, this meter, that the sensor that I brought, it does a lot of other parameters that the lab can't assess for. So whether that's dissolved oxygen, which is one of the most important ones, conductivity, water temperature, turbidity. Turbidity just means how cloudy the water is. Think of chocolate milk versus water, right? You can't see through chocolate milk, right? And then more. It all depends on what sensors you buy. And then I've just kind of shown some bottles there. That's often what our sampling bottles look like. A lot of them have preservative in them. So the reason we put a preservative in them is when you collect a water sample, things can start to degrade in the water sample over a short period of time. So we have preservative put in to keep them basically intact to the same conditions when they were sampled. It takes a while for samples to make it to a lab, so we also put them in coolers and we put ice packs in to keep them cold. Cold water stays a bit less volatile than warmer water. Biomonitoring, we've talked about this as well now. This is the most fun work that I've done at Kawartha. It just resembles what I was doing when I was younger at my cottage, and still what I do today. Right? I love fishing. I love the outdoors. It's the best. And people that don't get to be outside, you know, I feel bad because it's great for your mind. It's great for your body, and it's a heck of a lot of fun. So we've talked a bit about the electrofishing. Or fish sampling. We use nets or we use electrofishers. That's primarily the route we go. Plant sampling, we talked a bit about that. That's often done on the lakes, but also in creeks as well, too. We do habitat surveys, see what kind of plants are in the streams. OBBN, again, that's your bugs, so collecting bugs with nets in the water, similar to... Well, actually, I didn't include a photo there, but you can see some of the bugs that we're looking for. It's a very small photo here, but it's bugs in the water. And then habitat surveys. We also talked a bit about that. So any questions on those programs? We have a lot more that we do. I tried to break this down as simple as I could. Sound good? We'll keep moving on. Perfect. Okay. So now I'm going to talk a bit about one of the first volunteer programs that I took on. When I first started at Kawartha, I'd say around year two, I got approached because we have this climate change program that we're wanting to, you know, ramp up. And previously there was about, around 10 volunteers. They were only collecting precipitation data, so rain. They were looking at how much rain fell at their property. They would jot it down on a piece of paper and then send it in to us. And they would do that from April till September. But when I took on the program, I thought, okay, A, we need more volunteers. 10 is not enough. We have a big area. So my first goal was to gather more volunteers, get them in the program. So we did some campaigns, and we got a pretty good outreach from people who were interested. And what they were doing was collecting rainfall data every morning, April to September, and then they would continue that daily and provide me the data at the end. I would then kind of cross-reference that, basically compare it to our station data through work, and see if, you know, there's any accuracies or inaccuracies. And this program is directly helping our flood forecasting program as well, because in flood forecasting, you're dealing with a lot of rain, monitoring of rain. So it's a great program for that. And then I would produce a report at the end of the year kind of summarizing what was collected. Now, the other part of this program, which is definitely maybe more successful, in a certain way, is our water temperature program. So this is where volunteers throughout the lakes, they go out and they allow us to install a little logger. And I brought one. So these are just small, very, very small loggers. And all a logger does is record data. So it's about the size of, I say, a toonie, but they're very small. And they're pretty powerful little things, right? So these go in at in June, well, before June. They record from June 1st to August 31st. And they go in at the docks of volunteers. So any lakefront property owner who is part of this program will drive to their house, will install this on one of the legs of the dock, and it sits there throughout the summer, recording. And what it does is it records water temperature every hour on the hour. So every day you get 24 points of data, which is pretty cool. Now, an interesting thing about this as well is we've been doing this for about 6 years. I think it was 2020 that we started, and before I was working at Kawartha. And what's cool is we've developed quite a large data set of water temperature across the Kawartha Lakes. And the result of that is we are able to produce graphs that are quite accurate for a time frame. Now, unfortunately, in prepping this presentation, I couldn't find the actual graph on my computer, so I just took a photo of the one we have on the wall at the office, but hopefully this isn't too hard to see. You can see my laser, but essentially what this graph is showing is the dark blue line. That is the average temperature throughout the year. And the reason it's throughout the whole year, this data set, is the majority of our loggers are out in the summer, but we also have loggers out all year round, and they're installed on Trent Severn Waterway buoys. So the buoys in the water help guide people, guide boaters. They go out on those buoys for the whole year. So when you pair up the two data sets, you get a pretty good idea of what water temperature looks like throughout the whole year. So for example, what's cool about this graph is, let's say May 2-4 weekend, that just happened, right, a couple weeks ago. Let's say I was crazy enough to want to go swimming then. And I wanted to see, okay, what's the temperature going to be like? Am I going to be screaming, or am I going to be, you know, comfortable when swimming? And you can go and you can look at this graph and get an idea, okay, so it'd be right around 15 degrees Celsius around that time. Or you can see middle of the summer, right, July 1st, for example. You know, you're up there at 25, and I guess I'll also mention as well, you see these other two squiggly lines here, one there and one there. The top one is representing the maximum for that time period. And the reason this is part of our climate change program is we're trying to see, okay, what's the changes in temperature that we might see in our lakes? And this graph helps represent that. I mean, clearly, we've had data in certain years. Again, this is a total data, so everything's put together. But we've had days where we're almost at, you know, 33 degrees water temperature, which is nice, right? Nice for swimming. But what's the long-term impact on aquatic species and whatnot? So it's a very cool graph that we have here. Celsius, yes. 30. Yeah, so it'd be 35 Celsius, which if you see on the right, there's Fahrenheit. So Fahrenheit would be around 92. 92 Celsius wouldn't be fun. So yes, go ahead.
That's
at what depth? Yep, so that's at your near shore range. So basically anywhere from 2 meters deep to right at your shore. That's where these loggers are put. Yeah. So a little different than water out in the middle of the lake, right? You can imagine the lake temperatures are going to be much cooler out in the middle of the lake, and that is true. And if we were to split this apart from the other data, you would see that near shore versus central lake temperatures. So, any questions on that? Say again. Yeah, good question. So again, these little devices nowadays, they're very simple. So I just simply hold this button there, and that turns on a Bluetooth connection. So then I can go take my phone and just hit connect. It'll connect to the logger. I can download the data, and that's how we get it. Yeah. 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 And yeah, so we're definitely getting more trends of those days above. So our marker, we like to mark at 30 degrees, so any days above 30 degrees is quite hot for a nearshore water temperature, and we are noticing that there's more of those days occurring, sort of indicating a few things. Well, air temperatures are much hotter, you know, the summers are quite hot, and plus a lot of people are starting to do work on their shorelines, and what I mean by that is a natural shoreline often has trees hanging over your shoreline. Well, people are going and they're cutting those trees down because they want it all open and everything, and that impacts water temperature, right? So little things like that we'll see. Yeah. All right. Any other questions there? Is Sounds good. Keep moving. So now I'm going to just talk about community science. So this is how I got to be here today, is through Bruce, who's helped us with community science for the last 2 years. Community science, if we go back to 2019, Kawartha Conservation was doing near-shore water quality monitoring. Then COVID happened, and it kind of got pushed to the side. And once I started, they wanted me to revive this program as well. So over the last 2 years, we've rebranded it to Community Science. And basically, it's a water quality program for volunteers who live on the lakes to go and collect us samples, and we come and we pick them up. It's all volunteer run, so the only thing I'm doing is driving around and picking up samples, shipping them out, and then creating a report based on the data. And it's a great program because it blends in protection of the lakes, it blends in education for people, and it creates a sense of community for a lot of people. They want to be able to help protect their lake actively at their own homes, and this is the kind of program that can let them do that. So again, it's a nearshore monitoring program. So it's all about right in front of your property, right at the shoreline. That's where samples are collected. And the reason it's targeted that way is because the shorelines, your nearshore environment, it's actually known as what's called the ribbon of life. And the reason it's called the ribbon of life is because such a large volume of life lives in just that, 3 meter stretch out at that water, at the shoreline. You know, there's many fish that spawn in those zones. There's many, whether it's frogs, snakes, turtles, many species live in that area. And then the biggest species that lives in that area are humans, right? People are swimming always right at the shoreline. So it's a critical zone to monitor. It's all about water quality. As I mentioned, a lot of our programs, water quality. It's volunteer run, and it's throughout the Kawartha Lakes. So currently we are monitoring on Balsam Lake, Cameron Lake, Sturgeon Lake, Pigeon Lake, and Lake Scugog. We added Lake Scugog last year because they approached us with a big question mark of when did this program get made and we want to be a part of it. So we added them in. And they have a stewardship group there, and they help contribute to the program as well. But as you can see, a number of volunteers spread out throughout the lakes. And again, we're just trying to get what's called a representative sample, representative study area. Lots of spread across the lake. If everyone was grouped up in one spot, you wouldn't really get an idea of what's going on throughout the whole lake. So that's what we do there. As I mentioned, a large part of it is community engagement. So some of the funnest work I've done is going driving around to volunteers and chatting with them, right? It's great. I absolutely love it. Unfortunately, jobs change, and now I'm doing flood forecasting, as I mentioned. So I'm currently not leading this program. Someone else at my office is. But the community piece is huge. There's lots of people who want to protect their lakes. They want to be involved. And that's why these programs matter to us, and it matters to them. It's also about education and, getting the idea of a citizen scientist, and what that means is someone who, who cares about their waters, who cares about their neighbor, who cares about their property, and, when they go and hand their property down to their kids, they want it to be in the same quality that they got to experience, right? So it's an important part, and it's great people are able to participate. So for community science, we sample once a month from May to September. The samples, again, they're done at the nearshore environments. Some people do them at the end of their dock, which is totally fine. Some people do it right at the shoreline. Both are great samples, and they're both very similar in water quality. Some of the water quality parameters we look at are, I'll talk about them in the other slide, but one of the big ones, as this gentleman mentioned about septic tanks and stuff, is E. coli. So E. coli is becoming more and more of a targeted parameter when you're doing water quality work, mainly because of the health and safety risks that are associated with E. coli. You know, a lot of people swim in the lakes. There's a lot of beaches that monthly, or some of them weekly, but monthly sample for E. coli at the beach, right? Because the public are coming there, and they're trusting that those waters are safe, and they're not, there's not poop floating around, basically. So that's a big part of that sampling. And how the program works is we reach out to volunteers. They sign up. We train them. We tell them about health and safety. We provide them with a kit very similar to this, which includes bottles. So there's your sample bottles. Okay, so you'll get this, and you'll get a field sheet as well. You'll also get a a much smaller water quality probe. So this one's not 30,000. That one is. But you'll get one of these, and what this will record is water temperature as well as conductivity. So that's the starting stages of this program. And then basically at the end of the month, each volunteer goes and collects a sample, packages it up. We come by, pick it up, and we send it to a lab. And we do that from May to September. And that is essentially the process of the program. And then on the back end, I go and I create a report. I create a report and include all that data in that. For sure. Say again, sorry. So I provide the report to each volunteer. When you say look, do you mean like review? Yep. For sure. So the first piece with community science is we wanted the target audience to be the people on the lakes. So because we've identified, okay, homeowners are struggling to realize, you know, for example, putting out fertilizer, right? They're struggling to realize that that's ultimately going to hurt the lake significantly. And it has for the last 15 plus years. So our first target audience is residents. And we're not approaching them aggressively or anything, right? The goal is to show them ways to help mitigate their impact on the lakes. The same data collected in our other programs, that gets more applied to municipalities and whatnot. So earlier on when I talked about lake sampling and tributary sampling, those are the programs where we collect the data, and then we will take that data and approach municipalities for various change. Stewardship, which is basically working with whether it's companies or landowners or individuals, and helping to approach people that way. Make change through municipal changes and whatnot, bylaws, etc. But for this program, it's more targeted to the volunteer and letting them spread the word of, hey, just so you know, I came by last week and we were down by the dock and I noticed your lawn was, you know, bright green. There wasn't a weed on it. But have you ever thought of maybe reducing some of the fertilizer you've used, right? So that's sort of the approach. We're trying to get residents on the lakes to be aware of what things they can do to make a change. So hopefully that answers your question. Yes.
somebody redoes their shore line and puts it in the
Yep, definitely. So any sort of development activity from small scale to large scale, we do deal out those permits. So if someone is trying to develop on their property, they are going to have to come to our planning and permitting team and get a permit to, you know, make the change on their property. Again, department-wise, that's not what I do, but that is what our organization does, correct. Yep. Most definitely, yes, yes. And I'll talk about that very shortly here when we get into some of the data. Definitely. So you can hold on that thought there. Okay, I think we're good with this slide. So again, we've talked a bit about the data we collect. So one part of this program as well, as I've kind of mentioned this gentleman, is it's targeted to people on the lakes. It's targeted to people who maybe don't have a big scientific background. And I recognize that, you know, when I was at college, I would write these quite technical science-based reports. And if I went to my mom and said, hey, mom, read this, she wouldn't know what she's reading. Like, she really wouldn't. So I recognize that when I started working with volunteers, they're very similar to my mom, right? Maybe they don't have any environmental background. So I thought, okay, what's a way that we can approach these people with a report that's easy to read, easy to understand, and you can still get some value out of it, right? I talked about that piece of making change at home. So I started to make these magazine-style reports. I brought one, because that's the last one I have left. People really enjoy them. So I brought one here today, and it's much like a magazine where you can go and read through quite simply what the program is, our study area, what lakes are involved, and then the data that we got out of it. This has been a very popular approach. Our work has never really thought about things this way. Maybe this is my younger generation coming in, knowing that, you know, some people aren't sciencey people, right? And if we make this very elaborate report, your common resident in our community is not necessarily going to be able to read it. So for this program, it's a great approach, and I'm proud of making these. Okay, now we're going to get into a bit of what the actual data is and what we found. So first off, the parameters that we monitor for are phosphorus, chloride, nitrates, and E. coli. And then the two other parameters are water temperature and conductivity with that little meter I showed you. So for phosphorus, it's a nutrient. It's found in fertilizer primarily. You can also find it in agricultural practices. But in terms of a monitoring standpoint, high levels of phosphorus can rapidly cause excessive aquatic plant growth, so your weeds in your lake. So if there's a lot of fertilizer going out that's high in phosphorus, it's going to spike up the growth of those plants. And additionally, is there anyone here that's aware of algae blooms? Blue-green algae, we've heard of that before, yeah. Very, very dangerous. It can be fatal to people and fish and many other things. Well, when you have high levels of phosphorus, that can lead to excessive algae bloom growth. It's basically like, you know, it's like an energy drink for them. They just grow and grow and grow even quicker. Here, I'll move back here for you here. There we are. So phosphorus, again, nutrient, and it can definitely increase plant growth and algae growth. Chloride, off your question there, sir. So the question was, have we noticed or are we concerned with maybe the amount of road salt we're putting out into our roads here and in, you know, our watershed? The answer is yes. It's definitely become an issue. We see much higher levels of salts in our water over the last couple of years. Conductivity, again, salt and conductivity go hand in hand. If there's more salt in the water, there's more conductance of electricity, right? So higher salt, more conductivity. So we will see higher conductivity results, and conversely, we will see higher chloride. And it is primarily due to road salts. Now, it's a tough one. Road salt is very difficult, and I've always approached it this way. In Canada and in Ontario, we put out road salt for health and safety, right? I mean, for me, I've definitely had times where if there was not salt on the road, I'd be in big trouble. So it's a balancing act, right? It's making sure municipalities are aware, and they are aware, of road salt usage, and making sure that they're not overusing road salts, right? It's a fine balance. You want your members of your community to be safe, but you also don't want to damage the waters too much. And the problem with chloride is that many species all around us, all aquatic species basically, in the Kawartha Lakes, they're not saltwater species, right? This isn't the ocean. This is a freshwater system. The whole Trent Severn waterway is freshwater. So when they start to see more and more salt in their life, you know, in their gills and whatnot, it can impact them. So that's an important one to monitor. Then we get into nitrates. So nitrates, it's a nitrogen compound commonly found in you know, various plants and animals. And it's also a nutrient. So very similar to phosphorus, when you have high nitrates, you're going to see more of that excessive plant growth, excessive aquatic algae growth. And then E. coli. We talked a bit about E. coli and why we're monitoring for that. Again, it's what's known as a fecal contaminant indicator. Basically, it tells us, okay, well, there's poop in the water. And the reason it's important for this program, as mentioned, a lot of the residents on the lakes, some of them live in older homes. They have, you know, septic tanks that are older, degrading septic tanks, so they can leak out into the water. So just monitoring for that is just another bonus for us. And then we talked about water temperature and conductivity, so we can go past that. So now into some data. So today I wanted to talk about last year's data, and then later on I'll compare to the previous year. But from what we found last year, for total phosphorus specifically, is there's a couple lakes that are jumping up and down. For example, we use this top blue graph here. So that is Balsam Lake in the dark blue and Cameron Lake in the light blue. And the red line down the middle is known as the provincial water quality objectives. It's basically the threshold you don't want to go above. If you go above and you stay above it, things will start to happen, negative impacts on a waterway. So when looking at last year's results for Balsam and Cameron, pretty decent, right? Later in the year, we saw some spikes. That very well could have been from various rain events that happened that bring runoff from the land and bring it right into the creek. But for the most part, pretty good. And then you'll see total phosphorus at the bottom for different lakes. And the reason that they're split up is Ontario and the province, they have different markers for different lakes, right? So down south, Lake Scugog, they're a bit more lenient in their levels, right? They can be a bit higher. Whereas you get to Balsam and Cameron, more north, more clean lakes, they want to keep them that way. So their thresholds are a little bit lower. But for the most part, Pigeon Lake is a very clean lake for total phosphorus perspective. Lake Scugog will stand out throughout this assessment here as sort of an outlier. And unfortunately, it's just, you know, it's had a lot of pollution brought into the lake. It's a different geography, different kind of landscape. It's more southern. So you see more limestone, you see less granite and whatnot. But for the most part, total phosphorus is somewhat under control. Then we get into nitrates. So thankfully, nitrates are also extremely low. So you see that red line at the top. That is just our provincial, it's actually a long-term exposure limit for aquatic species. And as you can tell, all of the samples are quite low there, which is good. Just means that there's no big influx of nitrates. So we'll leave it there. Then we get into chloride. So this is your salt piece. And for the most part, I'll try to describe, again, sorry, it's so small. I'll try to describe some of these data points, but the tall green bars, if you can see those, that's Lake Scugog. So again, a lot of salt entering into Lake Scugog. But for the most part, as we can see, our water quality objectives, it's all below that. So that's a great indicator that there's not so much salt or too much salt going in the water. Yes, it's present, but it's not out of control to where you're going to start seeing some long-term problems with various fish species and whatnot. And then E. coli. So again, the trend of Lake Scugog, seemingly they have more E. coli being inputted into the lakes. Whereas other lakes, Balsam, Cameron, Sturgeon, Pigeon, the results are far less. But again, our provincial guidelines are still well above where we're sitting, and that's always good to see. So, any questions on any of that? Beautiful. Okay, then sort of a recap of this data compared to the year before. And again, it's tough. Making these graphs are great, but in the environmental world, you need a lot of data to make concrete recommendations, right? You need multiple years. You need 5+, 10+ years of data. We're only in year 2 of this program, so it's going to take time before you can start maybe going towards the municipalities and offering, some suggestions and whatnot. But what we can do is recommend things for homeowners, and that's what we still do. Total phosphorus, we saw sort of minimal change from 2024 to 2025. Nitrates were also lower than 2024, so that's a good thing. Your salt, your chloride, was similar to 2024 with some reductions in Sturgeon Lake. E. coli results were similar to 2024. Again, Lake Scugog was not on the program in our first year. Last year was the first year with that lake. So, again, it'll take more time to realize truly how impacted Lake Scugog is. Water temperature was lower in 2025 on average, and max water temperatures as well were lower. There's also lower average conductivity across all lakes, which is also good to see. So then this gets into the piece of, okay, what can we do? I'll just scroll down here. Yeah, so what can homeowners do? For phosphorus specifically, a big nutrient, we can limit the amount of fertilizer we use on our lawns. That's definitely the biggest one. Second to that is try to keep a natural shoreline. So maybe some of you are aware, but plants are very unique. They can essentially absorb bad things in the environment and store them in their, in their roots, in their material that they grow into, right? So their leaves, their stems, their roots, they can hold on to those chemicals and nutrients. So keeping a natural shoreline is very important, because if, let's say, you did put fertilizer down, well, when that fertilizer runs off into the water, it can get picked up by the plants and be stored in the plant. Helps it from not entering the waterway. Nitrates, very similar, as we've mentioned. Vegetation at your shoreline, native plants, are are a very good way of reducing nitrates into the water. You can also redirect downspouts to grassed areas and use rain barrels. And what that basically means is we've noticed that more people don't use rain barrels, oddly enough, nowadays. And for gardening and whatnot, even for your lawn, rain barrels can be a great way to water those areas rather than using municipal water. And from that perspective, if in the event you weren't using fertilizers, well, rain can often have a bit more oomph than municipal water, so it might help with some of the growth that you're looking for in a lawn. So that's that that point there. Chloride, as we've talked, big issue. Reducing the use of salt. So again, tricky area. We want everyone to be safe, but if you can, try and reduce the amount of salt you're putting out on your driveway, right? Try to shovel more often. Get snow off more often so it doesn't end up turning into ice. And then there's also alternatives. So at Canadian Tire and other places, you can get low salt alternatives, whether that's a mix of sand or in some cases people use beet juice. You can get beet juice that's condensed into like a fine powder, and that's mixed with sand, and that can be used as well to help with sand with ice. So reducing the amount of salt through those methods. And then E. coli specifically, the biggest one that I know the one gentleman mentioned is keeping your septic tanks updated. That's a big one. A lot of people have older septic tanks that do leak and they don't know it leaks. That can get into groundwater, which many people have wells and you're drinking that water. So making sure your septic tanks are updated and kept up to date is really important. Another thing that people don't think of is some people feed animals out on their front lawns by the water. I think it's great, but in some cases it can get out of hand, and now you have these birds and animals, essentially pooping on your lawn, and then when it rains, those animals have E. coli and all of that feces, and that can run into the water directly right from your lawn. And if, let's say, one of our volunteers were to sample prior to that, they would have quite a high E. coli spike. So small things like that. And then I guess just a comment. Volunteers, big thanks to them. Big thanks to Bruce and everyone else that's part of this program. They have a lot of passion, as I've mentioned, and we thank them for the work that they do. We also have some acknowledgements for our partners that help fund this. So we have a few lake-based groups, one being Balsam Lake Association, the Scugog Lake Stewards, and the Kawartha Lake Stewards Association. These are all science-minded people, residents who live on the lakes that are trying to protect them. And, they help provide funds to Kawartha to help make this work possible. So big thanks to them. Any questions on community science? Yes. For sure.
I was on council back in the 80s, right?
Yeah, it's a tough one. From our office's perspective, we are trying to remain positive. Anytime amalgamation or government start to step in, things can change rapidly. From what we've been told, with this amalgamation, this change for conservation authorities, is that none of the work we're going to be doing is going to get impacted. I won't lose my job. All of these staff won't lose their jobs. We'll still be able to do the good work we do. The things that we've been told are going to change are primarily like methods behind the scenes. So whether that's the planning of certain programs, management, there's a big focus on planning and permitting, because all conservation authorities, they all do planning and permitting in a different way. And they're trying to streamline it. Large part of this is streamlining so that everything's done the same. And in many ways, I'm okay with that. But we do have concerns, back to your question though, about is the public going to be able to voice their opinions? Are we going to be able to voice our opinions? Because, you know, currently I can make a change to any of these programs based off of, you know, a logical explanation, and I can make that change. But we are worried a bit about, you know, are we still going to have the say, the power to make a certain change to a program or a method, right? That's still up in the air. We don't know how that's going to pan out. But for the most part, we're trying to be optimistic. Big part of the amalgamation, too, is they're trying to bolster flood forecasting, which, hey, it's good for me. That's good job security. So, it's about streamlining. So hopefully that answers your question. And yeah, you have a follow-up. Yep. For me personally, I won't try to quote anywhere. I personally don't know. Again, I'm a water resource tech. I do work with water quality, but our water quality specialist is more the person to ask. And fortunately, he's not here today or to bounce questions off of. But I could follow up with you guys on that if you really want. But it's a tough one. I do know that these plants, the waste treatment plants, right? They do their best to not let contaminants out. Am I in agreement with some of the other practices? You know, when large rainfall comes, right, you get a big downpour. Often those places will just open the gates and they'll let out raw sewage, right? And, you know, as a 27-year-old guy who clearly does not agree with that, I you know, on your other question, I don't really have a voice on that, and I wish I could make more of an impact. And I don't know how these sorts of things get by. You know, I've been slowly learning that the political world is quite an interesting one to try and battle, if you will. So, yeah, wish I could answer better. Yeah. Yes, please. Sorry, sir. We should have more input, definitely. I agree.
But I just want to speak to you, you know, so important. And I think you see that here. Work of conservation is not just a nice thing to do. When you think about Midgard, the city of North Lakes, we're an area of tourism, cottage life, that's essential to our economy. And essential to that, of course, is to have good, clean, water, healthy water systems. And so the work that you do is critical. So we should be concerned about the fact that they're going to be consolidating the authority. But we're going to have less input. There's no question about that. The other thing I think about is flood forecasting. And a critical piece of flood forecasting is timeliness. And I think it would be ludicrous to think that by consolidating, that this is going to improve timeliness in flood forecasting. I think it could be detrimental, and it's something we should be concerned. The overriding thing here, we talked about earlier, streamlining process, making more efficient, both our provincial government and our federal government are trying to reduce red tape for development. They want to reduce all the restrictions, all the barriers, and they see one of the steps. If you want to develop property, you have to go through approval processes, and this is one of those steps that they want to minimize, if not eliminate, and that's the reason around it. We should be very concerned about that. But thank you very much for your presentation on this.
No, I appreciate it. I should bring you around more often when I need an explanation on that, because again, it gets tricky, right? I work for this organization, and I don't want to give out, bad information or wrong information. But everything he said, I 100% agree with. As much as I try to tell myself and in our office that it'll all be fine. There's definitely a lot of concerns. Definitely a lot of concerns. And unfortunately, I'm 27. I don't want to leave my job or lose my job. As you heard at the start, the reason I got into this work is because I love the outdoors and I want to keep it for my kids one day, right? And if there's more cutting of red tape and allowing more development and allowing more, suppression of your voice, then that can lead to a lot of problems. And, I appreciate your comment. So, any other comments there? Yeah, please. Correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, currently, it is the a mixture of the Trans-Severn Waterway and Parks Canada. Parks Canada being the primary. Correct. Yeah, we as a conservation authority, we don't. We are somewhat of an outlier in that. Other conservation authorities do manage dams. They have, dedicated dam operators. They work in conjunction with flood forecasting. But for Kawartha Lake specifically, for Kawartha Conservation, I do not manage dams at all. No. Yes. No, he said, have you ever heard of regular fishermen using the electrofishing unit? No, I have not. What's funny, too, is the electrofishing world's an interesting one because you don't necessarily, you don't need a permit to buy one. You can buy one and technically you can use it, but it's a very, exactly. No, it's a unique piece of equipment, but no. So I guess it's 12 o'clock. So is that end of presentation, correct? I think we had a good bit of discussion there. So hopefully you guys appreciate that. And I just want to say thank you again for inviting me. Great discussion. Hopefully I didn't bore you guys too much.